5:20, we're on the record. It's the Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism Committee. We are so excited about today's program. I want to thank Margaret Dowling for advertising because it got people here. We're so excited about having folks to listen to this exciting program. We want to hear from Jim Lynch first because you have a flight to catch this evening. Isn't that right, Mr. Lynch? So you're welcome to come on up. We are very anxious to hear from you. And then we're going to hear from Doug Ward, who we've been to Doug's, some of us have been to Doug's effort in Ketchikan, and it's unbelievable, and we're looking so forward to the PowerPoint presentation on that subject. But in the meantime, the floor is yours, Mr. Lynch. We're very happy to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Ramirez.
And I'm sorry, just for the record, Representative Tuck is here, and Representative Dugan is here. Representative Johansson will be a few minutes late, and then I think everybody else will come filtering in. So go.
Thank you. Was invited to be here this evening. My name is Jim Lynch. I'm from Fairbanks. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. And I've recently been elected chair of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board in my connection.
And where do you live in Fairbanks, Mr. Lynch?
In Mr. Ramirez's district.
Yes. So happy.
So when the email came, I responded.
Yes, we're very happy to have you here.
But I'm going to speak this evening, though, from my personal perspective, and so my comments are not necessarily the comments of the Workforce Investment Board or others. I share my personal insights. And would like to use your time well, so please direct me with questions if there's I'm unsure if there's a particular direction you'd like to go this evening, so I'll just make a few opening comments.
Okay. How long do you think your presentation is? 20? Is it 20 minutes?
Me?
Is it, yes.
I'm 5 minutes plus whatever you would like.
Perfect.
To.
We're very excited. Go.
I'm not sure how familiar the committee members are with the Workforce Investment Board. Its structure starts in statute. It is primarily, in my own words, a private sector advisory board to the Department of Labor. In effect, though, the board has a combination of both private sector members and certain designated seats from labor and from the public sector, including the Commissioner of Education, Commissioner of Labor, et cetera.
Yes. I'm sorry, how many on the board?
How many is a good question. If I may turn to a colleague. Here we have some supporters, approximately 27?
26.
26.
Thank you.
Members
okay.
In total.
Now, Mr. Lynch, you just used up your phone a friend opportunity.
Okay.
So all you have left is 50-50. Yes.
So understanding that, my understanding is that the broader focus of this group is the economy and some specific elements of that. And so I just want to touch on the AWIB, as we refer to, Alaska Workforce Investment Board, is with the cooperation of the new commissioner and deputy commissioner of labor making tremendous strides forward. Being new, I cannot speak in detail to the history, but on and off over the decades, it has been often a rocky road, and the board has not always been a welcome participant. With today's administration, there is certainly a cooperation that has not existed in recent years, and we have multiple new board members, a lot of energy and new direction. The AWIB now has I don't know the control would be the correct word, but significant discretion over STEP. Fund STEP is a workforce training program that's funded with UI dollars out of the Employment Security Division, Department of Labor. It's not general fund dollars. But it is a very, very potent training program within the state. Department of Labor can share any statistics that you'd like on that. But we are also looking into how to improve workforce development. I guess this is where I'd like to focus my comments, is workforce development is obviously tied to economic development. The age-old question, and I am not an economist to try and answer it, but is which come first? It's a supply-side or demand-side issue, and do you focus on developing jobs, and then the workforce will come to fill them, or do you develop the workforce in anticipation of the coming demand for that? My guess is, like with many issues, the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle. That's from my business perspective. But we are needing to look now at both the short term and the long term. Obviously, the gas line and the AGEA plan get a lot of attention, and it's a very, very important part of the puzzle because it does take years to ramp up highly skilled sectors of the workforce. Other programs requiring lesser training can be ramped up in a shorter time frame. So we, the private sector board, partner with and advise the Department of Labor, occasionally conflict with the Department of Labor, as is the nature of the vehicle, but to try and better the workforce development process and try and help set the priorities to focus on. We're evolving, but I think it's a very important part of the puzzle to have that private sector input. Workforce development is messy. There is no way to make it clean and concise. When I first got involved 9 years ago, I asked for some kind of flowchart or diagram. Here's the funding mechanisms. Over here are the programs. Down here are the employment needs. And how do we put it together? That does not apparently exist in our world. There's federal pass-through dollars, state general fund dollars, private dollars, and multiple competing training programs, and often a lack of detailed understanding of where we need to be focused. My opinion, it is what it is. We need to take advantage of the clear opportunities we can find, make the solid investments where we can identify them, and there are measures. It's not a perfect measuring system, but you can measure the effectiveness of a program. And so we, the board, are here to assist with that process. And I may stop there and ask, is there a particular direction or any questions that you have?
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, you touched on one of my main concerns with regard to workforce development, which is, you know, it's a suddenly popular thing to be involved in, and yet it's very difficult for anybody in our position to be able to tell sort of how much of it we're doing, whether it's we're doing the right stuff, if we should be doing other stuff, any of those kinds of questions, because there it seems to be a pretty sort of uncoordinated in that sense endeavor, that there's a lot of different people doing workforce development. And I think what you sort of said is it's just in the nature of the beast. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is my opinion. And I come at it from the private sector employer perspective, and I have been involved at the regional and local level for about 9 years in workforce development. And it is. We have twice in the 9 years in the interior, we've held employer forums, different formats each time, had numerous employers, community members come to the table. One of them was the Interior Issues Council effort from, I believe, 2 years ago. Identified top priorities. Workforce is always one of the top three or five priorities. But at the end of the day, it was like, okay, who's going to work on workforce? It was the same people that raised their hand because as a society, I don't think we totally know what to do. But we have identified some things that work. I'm aware of and share the concern that sometimes there is perhaps unnecessary duplication in which we can look for those efficiencies. I cannot tell you what they are, but I can confirm what you're saying, Representative Dugan, in my opinion, that I would not recommend in the short term thinking that you can fix the entire system and try to be as efficient as we can within what we have to work with, be my opinion.
Thank you. I want to announce that Representative Dahlstrom has entered the room.
Thank you.
Glad to have you in the room. So, Jim, question, Representative Tuck. So, Jim, what areas does the Workforce Investment Board? What placement? I mean, a lot of us have heard from the university about all their certification programs and credits that move you towards something. We're going to hear from Doug Ward about the similarities between shipbuilders and welders, for instance, that as you are creating shipbuilders, you're also creating an excellent application for welders, which is a pre-training for a pipeline. But I also will tell you about outfits like Neisser Construction or Samson Electric Nenana Builders, outfits that I know of in the Anchorage and Fairbanks area that develop a workforce, and they go from having a dozen jobs or 20 jobs to two or three jobs, and then this trained workforce dissipates. They go to where the work is. Oftentimes it's not in Alaska, and we have a workforce that migrates out of the state as rapidly as we try and replace the workforce in the state. So can you talk about those pressures as well as the different vocational interests that the Workforce Investment Board endeavors?
Yes, I can. And keep in mind, my perspective is not as an expert in workforce development strategies, but I'm private sector and I've got some hands-on experience with it. If with your permission, let me come at that in a roundabout way. First, I think for the state of Alaska, my recommendation would be we want to take a comprehensive look at the label tends to be workforce development. Could call it workforce readiness if you prefer. They're similar, if not certainly related. My personal viewpoint is view things in perhaps layers based on the type of training that's required for any given field. There are certainly advanced degree requirements at the top: doctors, attorneys, engineers, etc., pharmacists. Bachelor's level preparedness requirements, keeping in mind often bachelors or others require that plus on-the-job training. Then you have an associate's degree, and then you have various levels of on-the-job or certificate training in those layers. I absolutely cannot speak for the Department of Labor, but my perspective is that often the key workforce development part is primarily focused on the associate's degree and lesser requirements, because you can have on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground solutions that create trained workers and put people to work in a relatively moderate amount of time, and they're controllable to a certain degree. As a state, though, I think we can't ignore the other elements, which may often fall beyond the scope of the Department of Labor and our board. And I personally believe in looking at strategic tools. I grew up in Alaska and was educated in Alaska in the days of student loan forgiveness programs. And I've not priced that out to know where that would be today, but vehicles like that to help retain our young people or have them return after seeking advanced education outside, I think, is part of a total workforce development program. I think that has a significant economic impact when we look at the long term. We're all familiar with the brain drain in our community. Coming back to your question, Chairman, I'm sure there are examples, as you cited, of train people for a particular job, and then for whatever reason that job goes away, and then we've spent that money and then we have workers who aren't producing in that field. I do know that the Department of Labor and their various units have pretty solid data on that phenomenon, and on it is part of the measure of different programs is how many are working, what are they earning following the investment in them in a given training program that's state or federally funded. Keep in mind, too, that there's a lot of different, as you described, a lot of different vehicles, many successful. The University of Alaska system has multiple successful programs going. One I'm intimately familiar with is the School of Nursing out of UAA, with the cooperation of President Hamilton, our hospital in Fairbanks. We industry invested in the process, put up money and resources, and partnered with them to bring that program back to the Fairbanks campus after many years of absence. We're now graduating a class of 10 to 15 RNs every year, and in this year is an example where, although the local economy is still strong, we are looking to be cautious and scale back. We would not normally move to hire these nurses, but with our commitment to that program, we're going to hire at least 10 nurses out of that graduating class, even though it may not be our first economic choice due to that partnership. That's a great success. You're going to hear about the shipyards in Ketchikan, a great example of a private-public partnership that is giving people transferable skills, which I think is your point, very successfully. And there are numerous examples around the state, and they come in all different shapes and sizes. I would encourage you to someday talk with Jerry Andrews, who's the apprenticeship coordinator for the Department of Labor, gave us a fabulous presentation today. He has examples from tiny mom-and-pop companies to larger organizations putting in apprenticeship theory to work in a wide variety of disciplines where it has not been used before. It's a very interesting success story. So I don't know the answer to how we prevent the occasional loss, but I do think there's smart people involved who can better answer that question.
So, sure. Yes, sir. Representative Tutt.
Thank you. I appreciate you talking about how complex it is and how it's getting attacked from all sorts of different angles and all different types of methods. I'm a product of the apprenticeship program, I'm proud to say. And one of the nice things about the apprenticeship program is that not only did it teach me the skills that I needed to provide for my family, but it also taught me some life experiences and just working with a journeyman. It taught me how to better cope with people, how to handle my finances, and so on and so forth. And it is a complex issue. I know that one of my concerns is that we are not capitalizing on the investments that we're making on students coming through elementary, junior high, and in high school. And as you said, some of our best and brightest minds are leaving the state of Alaska pursuing higher education elsewhere, getting locked into those communities. We no longer have the forgiveness program, and I am also one that was in the forgiveness program. And I see how that greatly benefits, but then we have no mechanism to get these people back once they go on to higher education. When we need when budgets shrink for education dollars into our school districts, it's cheaper to prepare people for college than it is to prepare them for career and technical education. And one of the things I've been trying to figure out is how do we get a grasp on that? And I think Department of Labor, I think sometimes some of our money should be coming through the Department of Labor towards educating our kids, our children in the high school, junior high level, rather than coming through the Department of Education Early Development, because it seems to get washed out. It seems to get gets convoluted. When I was serving on the school board, we opened up the King Career Center for summer school. And these summer school programs have been successful. We have been packed, busting at the seams, to where last summer we did it again, and we were able to open up two sessions of summer school. And now we have King Career Center that we have after school, because there's such a demand. And what's great about doing some of the career and technical education is that it is keeping students engaged, it's making things relevant, and it's keeping them in school. When I was running for school board, my big thing was workforce development. I had an attorney call me up and said, hey, I really want to thank you for pushing the workforce development, because he had taken some shop classes when he was younger in high school, and although he never pursued, his career went on to become an attorney, he appreciates the skills that he learned during those times to provide for his family in different ways of saving money from having to take his vehicle to the shop or doing stuff around the house. So I think it's really important that we continue to find ways to promote, continue to find ways to provide, and to really meet the needs that are going on out there. Because as we lose those best and brightest minds in the state of Alaska, when we need skilled labor, we're pulling them up from Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Texas, because we're not able to develop them right here. So just a better way of developing our own within. So thanks for allow me to speak, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for presenting as you did.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, may I make...
Please.
I think you hit on something there that's important, and that there are these... someone said it during our board meeting over the last 2 days, and that there are programs and people out there that are changing one life at a time, in whether it's teaching a skill or creating a job, and so... The challenge at the legislative level, at the administrative level, is trying to identify those programs that are effective over time to to look for ways to make the system more efficient. We had a discussion over an initiative that'll be on the table soon, which is discussing possibilities of centers of excellence. Is there a way that we can better identify what really works and doesn't? These things are being worked on, and the last comment I'll make in regards to your discussion was the education and labor, technical education and traditional education, are at the table and intertwined. However, that theme is common in many groups because it is obvious or the opinion of many that within K through 12, even though Alaska has tremendous education programs, they're, you know, societally, whatever changes are going on are leading to a lot of young people not coming out being job ready. We talk about shovel ready. We have people who are not shovel ready. And there are a number of great programs going on in that too, but system-wide across the state, we clearly have yet to stop that negative trend and redirect it, in my opinion.
And if I may, I appreciate the question and the answer. If I may, just to be, just to point out, one of the most effective work training programs that we have in the state of Alaska. We have some guests in the back of the room that are right in front of the flag. Ladies, would you please stand up so I can introduce you? This is, I want to go in the right order because we all have protocol here, so I want to go from the president on down. Rachel Kinley is the state president of FFA. And then Taylor Berberich is the state secretary from FFA. And Corrine Ogle is the state reporter. And they're accompanied by Jeff Werner, who's the state FFA advisor. We have hundreds of kids that go through the FFA program. And if you want to talk about the best and brightest, thank you, ladies. These three young ladies, one of them finished second in the nation in the national events for FFA. And you want to look at some of the best and brightest that we have coming up. It's these people where we are seeing a very successful transition from K through 12, and these are the young leaders of our future. So, ladies, we're very happy that you joined us here in the back of the room. Are there other questions for Mr. Lynch?
Thank you for having me, and appreciate the good work you are all doing, and you will enjoy the discussion of the Ketchikan Shipyard. It is a good example of what's possible out there.
And could you get us to Margaret, and we'll see that it's distributed to the committee. Very tangible examples of, you know, just a kind of a one or a two page summary of what the Workforce Investment Board is doing right now. Because philosophically, I think we all grasped exactly what you're doing, but we would love to see, I think, a demonstration of the tangible output of where that effort is going, and that would be helpful to us. And we're very grateful to have you as a resource. And I would offer, Jim, not only our thanks for having you come, but I would offer that the key thing, perhaps, when you posed to us that what's necessary first, the jobs or the workforce to do the jobs, that in fact maybe what's the cornerstone is the cost of energy, that perhaps that's the foundation for the state of Alaska is cheap energy and a robust economy. And we have seen the economy break in various areas of the state now, and we have seen it begin to teeter in the Cook Inlet region because we're beginning to run out of the lowest cost energy, which has been a driver for the South Central market for the last 20 years. And here in this committee, we were looking at the decline in commercial and residential building permits just a week or two ago. And when we start to look for the catalyst that would drive that back up, it's not necessarily presently a workforce or the job training. It's the quality of the economy. And when we look for the drivers of the economy, I would say that energy is certainly the cornerstone, and the availability of capital. And our banking system is healthy in Alaska, but our energy, our source of energy for many parts of the states is greatly retarded relative to, you know, the robustness that South Central has enjoyed in the last 20 years. And you follow the growth in the Mat-Su and the Anchorage area, and it's an archetype for a successful economy. You look at Fairbanks or Juneau or other parts of the state, And the state has had to step in and be a crutch oftentimes to help those communities limp along. So how do you feel about that?
I don't consider myself overly knowledgeable in the details from surface level. Obviously, the cost of energy across the state, particularly in the areas where the cost is far more out of control.
Yes, sir.
It is such a significant economic driver. I mean, I can envision our own financials for our organization in my head, and we got a free pass this year with energy prices moderating from what we were anticipating. We have no doubt, of course, that those very high energy prices that will be back, $5 a gallon for oil or gas.
And precisely on that point, isn't that one of the things that's curbing growth is the fact that you have an expectation that high costs are going to come back? If you had an expectation that we were going to have moderate costs and that you could forecast those for 10 or 20 or 30 years, isn't that precisely one of the robust drivers that's missing? Is by your own admission, you expect high costs to come back, which means it shades all of your future decisions about hiring in a workforce, investing in a workforce, because there is no certainty. The element of certainty has been removed from whatever economic formula you're going to overlay onto a potential opportunity, whether it's the hospital or in your capacity as the chair of the investment board. And so I would just suggest that for economic development, trade, and tourism, that the economic development part isn't so much subject to the trained workforce, but what would we do with the trained workforce, and what will be the magnet or the catalyst to keep a trained workforce active here in the state?
Excellent point, Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're so happy
to have you here. Thank you.
Closing remark, to echo what you said on the FFA leaders, we had the pleasure to hear from them today. If you end up with time, I would highly encourage you hearing from some brilliant young women.
Thank you. We might take you up on that. That would be wonderful. Doug, do you want to? Doug, if you want, we'll just take 5 minutes, and why don't we have these young ladies come up and give us a 5-minute presentation on what the FFA is doing? I think it would be wonderful to get you guys. Come on, ladies. I heard Rachel speak today, and a very articulate young lady. Pull up the third chair. Welcome to the hot seat.
Well, make sure you come in and sit in the back and not say anything.
Yeah, so. and look what happens. So if each of you will introduce yourself for the name, you put your name on the record, and then Rachel, if you will give us a 5-minute spiel, because you are a phenomenal speaker, but if each of you will introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Rachel Kenley. I'm the state president. I'm from Palmer High School, and I'm a senior.
My name is Corinne Ogle. I'm the state reporter. I'm a junior, and I'm from Homer High School.
My name is Taylor Burbrick. I'm a senior this year at Palmer High School, and I'm the state secretary.
And Corinne, very quickly, what were you involved in, and what did you win?
My team won first place at the state convention for environmental science, and we went to nationals for that competition, and we won second place nationally there.
And would you very quickly articulate the project that they gave you at nationals, just because it's phenomenal?
It's a series of tests at first. You go over things like soils, waters, forestry, and wildlife, and you go through and they have you in the field and you're answering questions about things. You're actually testing the water and the soils and stuff. And then you have this presentation that you put together. They give you a problem, and our problem was housing development. They had this plot of land that they wanted to do housing development on. And we had to come up with how we'd go about this, how everything would affect the soils, the wildlife, the forestry, and everything in that area. And we did quite well in that presentation, and we got second place for all that combined.
Quite well indeed. Second place in the country?
Yes.
In the United States? That is pretty awesome. Rachel, would you take 2 or 3 minutes and just tell us about the FFA program? How many kids are involved across the state? And what your kind of your raison d'etre is, what the FFA is about, please.
Absolutely. we are state officers, and we're here in Juneau this week to celebrate National FFA Week. And so we're just kind of here telling everyone about our mission. So the mission of the FFA is to make a positive difference in the lives of students by developing their potential for premier leadership, personal growth, and career success.
And we believe that that has made a huge difference in our lives. And as state officers, we've been able to see the difference that it's made in the lives of the students throughout the state and throughout the country. And so we believe that it's especially important in schools to have agricultural education, and in Alaska to have that education include natural resources, things like mining, fisheries, developing those things which our state depends on, so that our students can have this education and then become the leaders of the state, so that our state can be self-sufficient in those things that we rely on. So throughout this year as state officers, we've been to a lot of different places, especially in the state of Alaska. We've been to Kodiak, Fairbanks, Homer, and Palmer, presenting leadership conferences for the students there. We've visited all the different areas that we have strong FFA programs in, which we have about 7 active chapters and a couple more in the works right now. Homer came down to Palmer and did a farm tour, and we've just been facilitating a lot of different events like that. And we're actually retiring in a couple months. There'll be a new set of state officers elected at our state convention. We're really excited for our state convention. It's in April 22nd through the 24th, and everyone is invited if anyone wants to come down to Palmer. We're really excited to have a really big event. It starts on Earth Day, and we'll have competitions such as the ones that Corinne just described, in natural resources, parliamentary procedures, leadership events such as public speaking, and all sorts of different things there. So that's pretty much what we're about. We have about 150 members in the state right now, and we're trying to expand that and get quality agricultural education programs at different high schools.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. And Corinne, Taylor, do you have anything that you would like to add?
I'd just like to add that FFA is not only about livestock and spreading agriculture, it's the best leadership opportunity I've ever had in my life. I've grown up in agriculture. My dad is the chapter advisor for Palmer. And nowhere else would you learn how to speak. Nowhere else would you be able to come to a place like this in high school and talk to legislators and representatives. And we've had international opportunities. We've gotten to speak to President Bush, right, at the end of his term. And I can't think of a single other organization, club, that would be able to do something like that.
And are all three young ladies, are you college bound?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Questions?
Impressed.
So impressive. What do they say? A picture says 1,000 words. You just got about 100,000 words out there. Representative Dugan?
I don't have a question. I just wanted to make a request that none of you young ladies, when you get out of college, move into my district.
One of you move into his district.
If any of the three of you are Republicans, we would request that you consider it. ladies, wow. I think you blew the whole room away, and the most nervous person in the room right now is Doug Ward behind you, who has to follow you now at the presentation on the Ketchikan Boatyard. Congratulations. Thank you for coming up in such an impromptu fashion. You're extraordinary role models.
Thank you.
Well done. And we thank Mr. Werner, who is their state FFA director. Great job, ladies. I think you guys can see why I employ a dozen to 15 of these young people every year for our hydroponic and our agricultural program. Every one of them, when you scratch the surface, it's nothing but granite underneath. Unbelievable, unbelievable young people. We've been joined by Representative Johansson and Doug. We tried to soften it up for you. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could just fold my tent after that and go home, but I do want to leave some job applications with these young ladies.
Okay.
But that last comment about their being given the opportunity to learn leadership is one of the best things I've heard all day. And it's that kind of leadership that we're looking for in our industry to return the U.S. shipbuilding industry back to one of the global economic powers that we once used to be. My name is Doug Ward. I'm the Director of Shipyard Development for Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. We are the private sector operator of the state-owned Ketchikan Shipyard. We are engaged in a public-private partnership that is supported by concurrent development of the infrastructure, the market, and the workforce of the shipyard in Ketchikan that will have the capacity and the regional competitive advantage to attract new private investment and the jobs and the good family wage jobs that come along with that. So I've got about 17 slides here. There's not too many words or numbers on them. If you have any questions I'm going along, please feel free to interrupt me, as I don't really have a set speech. Well, I went right to the end, home, page down. The planning for the Ketchikan shipyard began in the late 70s following the buildup of the Alaska Marine Highway System fleet in the 1960s. By the end of the 60s, AMHS had about 9 vessels, and all of the activities associated with operating that marine transit system was supported out of Seattle, out of Pier 54. All of the headquarters activities, the manning and crewing of the ships, and the maintenance and refurbishment of those ships all went on in Seattle. And there were a few people in Ketchikan at that time, a particular fellow from Ketchikan. There was the Southeast Conference that helped develop the Marine Highway System, saw that enormous outflow of jobs and spending going down to Seattle, and felt that it was time Alaska grabbed its economic future, built a shipyard of its own, and returned those spending dollars to the state. So that was the, as well as the employment, that was the impetus for building what is essentially a bus maintenance facility in Ketchikan. It's a shipyard that supports Alaska's marine transit system. The system now has grown from Alaska Marine Highway System. We now have the airport ferry system in Ketchikan, which looks like we'll have that for quite a while. We have the Inter-Island Ferry Authority. And
my own people, Mr. Chairman.
And maybe we could just pause there for a second and just let the room exhale.
That's right.
Fortunately,
who
invited this
now?
Guy?
You need a
Representative Johansson will fix that in short order, though. Which, and that hard link will always be supported by the ferry system. And we also have the new Cook Inlet Ferry, which we'll talk about in a little bit, which is a really exciting vessel that we're building in Ketchikan. At any rate, the planning began for the shipyard in the late 70s and the early 80s. The State of Alaska Department of Transportation bought the Sunny Point Cannery site, and that's the top left-hand picture there. We actually came across the original plat for the Sunny Point Cannery, 1922, and it identified shipbuilding repair as an activity that was going on that site as far back as 1922. So today, the Alaska Shipping Dry Dock occupies that site, and we've got a lot more shipbuilding repair going on. This is what the shipyard looks like today. In the center, you can see the Matanuska sitting in our 434-foot-long, 10,000-ton lift capacity floating dry dock that was installed by the state in the mid-80s. Out in front is the Columbia Pierside. And back at South Berth in the background is one of the aluminum fast ferries, all operated by Alaska Marine Highway System. In the middle is a blue building. It's a little hard to make out on that picture, but that's the existing shop that was the only building that supported the yard when it opened in 1987. This is the development plan that we have in place now that we began with in 1999. It's really a restatement of the state's own 1981 plan. The existing shop building that you saw in the previous photo is that little dark block behind those very large enclosed ship repair halls. We have a new floating dry dock is there. It arrived in 2007, and you can see it in this picture sitting next to the existing floating dry dock with the Columbia in it. The new dry dock has one of the Coast Guard buoy tenders in it. And that new dock is in its lift and launch position where it takes ships out of the water and puts them back in. You'll see some lines to the left of the dry dock. Those are pile-supported grounding grids. And at high tide, the new dry dock will translate sideways, ballast down onto those grounding grids, whereupon the main deck will be level with the land. And there's a rail system that will allow us to transfer 250-foot long ships onto land level enclosed all-weather repair berths. You're going to hear me talk about globally competitive standards a lot. Everything we do in that shipyard is based on globally competitive standards, including the footprint and the layout of the infrastructure that we're talking about here. And not to contradict Chairman Lynch, he is true that workforce development is a messy process, but it doesn't have to be. And in enterprise as complex as shipbuilding, we need to have repeatable, enduring standards that guide everything we do, both in the layout of the work, in how we develop our workforce, and how we satisfy our customers' needs. If we can't do that, we're not competitive. These are some of the features that are coming online now. Over the years, and when we presented in 1999, began presenting our vision for the shipyard, we used the principles of concurrent development in order to demonstrate that this project was going to be different than another bricks and mortar project that we can build and then wait for something to happen. By using concurrent development, by building the infrastructure, the market, and the workforce concurrently, we will remove risk to the enterprise and assure success and full employment at the end of the day. We are also dedicated to reducing the cost of operating ferries in Alaska. This is an unfortunate circumstance. It's fortunately, in this case, this is a Lituya that on January 30th was blown away from her moorings in Metlakatla in 90-mile-an-hour winds, went up on the rocks. A little hard to make out, but it is amazing that no one was injured in that accident and that we didn't lose that ship. It went up and pounded on that rocky island for all night long. And fortunately, it did come to rest as the tide went out. It didn't turn over and capsize. On the right, you can see, on the left at the bottom, there is the hull where it was banging. The rolling chock is folded up and bent in. It doesn't look like there's much structural damage to the ship. But over on the right, in the top picture, a little hard to make out, as we took the hull plate off, all of the internal frames in there were compressed and wrinkled and deformed. In the bottom, we've cut out that deformed steel, replaced with new plate, and put in there. We expect to have her back into service next week. The savings is considerable in an event like this by having a regionally available maintenance facility. Right off the bat, if we did not have a shipyard in Alaska, we'd be looking at probably a week-long tow of a stricken vessel with increased threats to life at sea, with both the towing vessels and any crew on the ship, threats to the environment in case she sank and leaked and had all that associated wreckage, and the time out of service, at least a week travel one way down there, if there was anybody available to take that ship in Seattle. The Alaska Marine Highway System, the Seattle shipyards, don't have the same relationship with the Alaska Marine System Highway that we do. We are committed to maintaining and reducing the cost of operating ferries. That's why we have a shipyard in Ketchikan, and in fact, it's over 50% of our business. And we don't have the capacity to do all of it, but when something like this happens, we had the Taku, and we had hull plating out of the Taku at the time of this accident. We went to town, put on three shifts a day, got the hull plating back on the Taku, put her back in the water in less than a week, and had the Lituya back up, and we'll have her in service next week. So continuous revenue, all kinds of savings by having a shipyard in Alaska. Before I forget, our present employment today is about 139 jobs down there. In 3 to 5 years, build out of the new improvements at the shipyard, we'll be approaching around 350 full-time, year-round, well-paying jobs in what is considered a high-growth job initiative, which is advanced manufacturing. That's what we do to build these ships. This is the market for us. This is the MV Susitna, which is the world's first twin-hulled ice-breaking ship. And these aren't my words, but they're others from people that know. One of the most complicated ships to be designed in the last 100 years. It's an Office of Naval Research demonstrator project. It'll be used by the Marines. Its Navy name is called E-Craft, E for Expeditionary. Its job is to take Marines and M1A1 battle tanks 100 nautical miles from forward located sea bases, 100 nautical miles, take high payloads at high speeds in high sea states, 30 knots in 15-foot high waves, approaches the surf line, slows down. The center cargo deck is mounted on very large hydraulic cylinders. Mm-hmm. It goes from a deep draft high speed mode, slows down into a barge landing graph mode by depressing the center cargo deck.
Wow.
Gives it a flat bottom, goes from 13 feet of draft to 3 feet of draft, and as you see here, drives up on the beach and launches tanks and Marines that go do the work that they have to do. They load back up and they go to the next hot spot. It's the littoral war on terrorism, and we're building that in Ketchikan. It will be demonstrated as a ferry crossing the Kinnick Arm from Anchorage over to the Matsuburo. The Navy was interested in that particular body of water because it is one of the most difficult transits in the world. It's got, 28 feet of tide, currents, wind, ice, sediment, shallow waters. It's a really nasty place to operate a ship, and that's why the Navy wants to test it up there.
So, Doug, is your intention when this is completed to take over the Kinnick Arm or to take over Anchorage? Which is the which is the objective?
We'll let the Marines make that decision. And I suppose there's some senators that might have some influence on that.
How did we bid for and win the contract to participate in building these demonstrator vessels? And what's the opportunity if it's successful? Is it something that Alaska could keep? Are we handicapped by our geography, or is it precisely the opposite?
That's a great question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that. The reason that we were given this ship, this concept, was being designed by Lockheed Martin in support of the Navy's Forward Sea Basing Initiative. But the Office of Naval Research is interested in, it's all about science and technology, and this is a science and technology project. The transformability, the changeable geometry of this thing is what the Navy is really interested in, and that's the mousetrap that we're demonstrating. But when they, actually, the way this worked was a fellow was working for Lockheed that grew up and went to high school and service high school and went on to a naval career. And when he heard that the Matsuburo was entertaining a ferry, he'd been working on this Forward Sea Basin Initiative. He ran up to Anchorage, got a hold of John Duffy, and showed him a much different looking E-craft 5 years ago. And John Duffy said, "Man, that looks like a pretty cool looking ship. Let's build it." And Lou was getting ready to go back to the Skunk Works with Lockheed Martin down in Sunnyvale, California. And John said, "Just a minute, not so fast. There's only one catch here. You got to build it in the state." So we want to thank John Duffy and that kind of thinking that and confidence in Alaskans that we can do that, that we can do this kind of work. So at that point, the Office of Naval Research heard about that, and Admiral Cohen traveled to Ketchikan and met with us to see. I mean, they didn't even know we had a shipyard up here. But after 3 days of being in the yard, he saw that the Alaskan workforce has inherent innovative capabilities because of the fact that you can't go down to the corner hardware store and get a new part,
wow,
particularly in this kind of business. So he saw the multi-skilled, can-do work ethic that exists in the Alaskan workforce, saw that our company, Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, was open to innovation and ready to jump ahead, and that's how we got into the science and technology business. Admiral Cohen had enough confidence in Alaskans to put this $60 million ship into Alaska.
Wow.
So it's built on the multi-skill capability of the Alaskan worker and our ability to innovate and do these wonderful projects in a rainforest, in a wilderness. So thank you. That's a good question. The other point is, yes, we will keep this ship. The commercials, this is a tough, purpose-built ship built for the toughest waters in Alaska. It's ice-strengthened. This is called a SWAT hull, small water plane area twin hull, and because of its stability in high sea states, is being used now, this hull technology is being used to service and deliver crews to the offshore oil rigs in the Gulf, because that's a shallow body of water down there in a very steep wave pattern. And they want those workers on those 6 and 10 hour transits to show up at those rigs ready to go to work, not seasick. So it also fits the transportation missions that exist in Alaska. Small populations separated by long distances with difficult water. This ship can handle it. The hulls on these are so highly designed by Lockheed Martin that as a transit system, as a bus across the Kinnick Arm, it's got 4 2,700 horsepower engines each, and everybody thinks that this is going to be an economic boondoggle. But the reason it has that much power is to demonstrate the Navy's requirements for driving M1 and A1 battle tanks 10 knots through 2 feet of sea ice. As a ferry, under normal operating conditions, they only need to run 2 of the engines in a derated state, and as a ferry at 15 knots, it'll use 7.5 gallons of fuel an hour. It's fuel efficient. It's because the hulls are so, has so much science in the shape of that hull. It's so efficient. So as we look forward to the opening of the Northern Sea Route in both directions, as the commerce goes out there, all of the science and oceanography that has to be done, this is a perfect ocean research and oceanographic boat. It can be go up and down and approach ice flows and put scientists on and off and get back to town fast. It's our global standard for our market. So we've got a global standard for the shipyard. It was designed by some of the smartest shipyard designers in the world from Helsinki, Finland. And we now have a ship that's setting the global standard for polar transportation and research. I want to get to the workforce, because this is, by the way, we're low bidder on this project. Is an $8 million marine fueling station for Chevron. They want it down in the port of Vancouver in time for the Olympics, where their corporate headquarters are, because the one they have is 30 years old and is rusty.
And we're not in a hurry. Doug, we're not in a hurry.
Oh.
We're not in a hurry. This is a very compelling presentation. You just take your time.
All right,
Chairman.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Speaking
Doug's
of
always in a hurry. That's why you get so much done.
Well, I got to catch up with these young women and get an application to them. We also are the low bidder on the Ketchikan's new replacement ferry at around $7 million. We're $1 million less than the next closest bidder down in Puget Sound. We are competitive, and we can save this state money because we base our everything we do on globally competitive standards.
Can you go back to tell us about the project before the marine refueling? You said the Olympics. I apologize.
Right. Yeah. That the marine fueling station. It sits right down in front of the corporate headquarters of Chevron in Vancouver, BC. And it was built in Puget Sound. It's a rusty, ugly old thing. It's not very handsome. And when the Olympics happens, Chevron wants a brand new marine fueling station. It's a little mini market and things. It's kind of a complex fueling barge.
Recording started.
You're good.
Finally.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty visible and high-profile project. And interestingly enough, it's an export from Alaska. We are now exporting something other than a natural resource. It's a manufactured product. So, again, that wasn't the initial mission of having a shipyard in Ketchikan. The original title was the AMHS Alaska Marine Highway System Winter Vessel Maintenance and Layup Facility. The reason, though, that it's grown and we're bringing shipbuilding in is that some of the original findings and the feasibility studies for the yard found that Marine Highway System's annual maintenance budget in and of itself was not large enough to support a shipyard with all of the capabilities and capacities required to do all of its maintenance mission. So the recommendation was that, well, they went out and looked at the other fleets that exist in Alaska, and they found between 1,500 and 2,000 vessels, all 250 feet or less, 2,500 long tons or less. Not counting cruise ships and oil tankers, the bulk of the ships that work in Alaska, NOAA, fishing vessels, Coast Guard, are all 250 feet and less. So everything that you see in that in the infrastructure is all designed around maintaining and building 250-foot-long ships. But we do have that one very large dry dock that lets us get the large ferries and the larger ships in the Bering Sea factory trawler fleet and things.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doug, does that mean that there's a lot of talk now about this new Alaska-class ferry that the Marine Highway System is talking about building, which I think is somewhat longer than that 250-foot, at least the concept is at this point? Does that mean that your outfit wouldn't be able to compete for the contracts to a contract to build one of those boats?
No, sir. Interestingly enough, one of the most successful shipyards in the West Coast was in Vancouver, B.C. It was called Allied Marine, and they made their living for many, many years building ships for Canada's inland waterways, and they built them for rail haul to the lakes and the rivers where they were going, and they built them in modular, almost bolt-together sections. So with that large 434-foot-long dry dock, we can build a ship 450 feet long. What we can do is build sections of a ship on those land level within those enclosed buildings, put them on the smaller dry dock, launch them, bring them around, and put them in the large dry dock, and weld them together and get up to possibly a 450-foot-long ship. We have talked to Marine Highway System about the Alaska-class vessel. We're very interested in that project. And I'm going to get a little off topic here before I get to workforce, but as we were talking to them, ships are pretty complicated structures. In fact, if you consider size, they are the most complicated structure that mankind builds, and that's taking into account aerospace. They are floating cities. Shipyards are stationary. Public works departments, and we do everything a public works department does except build roads and bridges. But we do it under a very, very heavy regulatory climate. We have owners' requirements on schedule. We have to work in very tight schedules and in very confined spaces. It's a complicated process, and in the design process of any ship, there's a point where the marine architects meets with the shipyard, and they go through what they call design for producibility. And this is a new concept for marine architects. They're not used to talking to people like me that know how to build ships, and they don't like it, because when they come and see us, we look at them and go, well, that's really a beautiful line, and it's a nice curve, but we can't build that. So then we sit down and start negotiating, the design on what we can do. In talking to the Marine Highway System, we want to become a partner in that early. We want to work with the department, help them design a ship that fits our Alaska capabilities. And our Alaska capabilities are considerable. It's not that they have to diminish the capabilities of the boat, but we wanted to reduce the cost and build an efficient vessel, work with the department early as a team member on that design team. And that brings to the notion that hasn't been identified yet, but that we talked about last week, and that would be to develop the procurement process similar to the design process, and we coined the phrase, how about procurement for producibility? And I think that's an area that this nation needs to get to, and in particular this state. Standard approach to public procurements is design, bid, build, with award going to low bidder. And the notion is the risk is transferred to the contractor by having heavy liquidated damages and all kinds of penalties and clauses in the contract. But the owner, generally, is in entire control of the concept design up to the detailed design, to the contract design, to issuing the procurement documents, determining the award, awarding the contract, and then managing the contract. So no risk is shifted at all. In fact, we as contractors do not accept risk, and if we do, we don't do it for free. And all those liquidated damages do is drive up the cost that we, it's in our price, somewhere in our unit cost, in our bid, it's there. So part of this notion of an effective public-private partnership, and this is why it's working so well with ADA, it really is truly becoming an effective partnership. And what's going on is we're identifying the different classes of risk that exist in the enterprise, and then we identify which of the partners can manage that risk best, and then we let them manage it and get out of the way. So ADA is essentially the financial arm of the partnership, managing the financial end, and we're the operator. We identify the state, and we're the ones that are figuring out what the globally competitive standards are for infrastructure, for the market, and then for the workforce. So it's working pretty well, and we're real happy with that partnership. So we'd like to see that move on into future procurements.
Doug, Representative Tuck has a question, then mm-hmm. Representative Dahlstrom.
Just real quick, can you, again, give us that procurement term again? Procurement for?
For producibility.
For producibility. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's a new term. There's a lot of things we do down there that have never been done before, a lot of global firsts. And what you're looking at here is another one. This is an advanced manufacturing process that when the marine architect that we were talking to initially, and these are stiffened hull panels that have compound curves in them for the MV Susitna, it means there's curves in both directions. When he saw what we were proposing here, and basically what we do are use those hydraulic arms, come down and forces hydraulically the curvature into the plate, then we use automatic welders for along those longitudinal stiffeners. There's 40 miles of welds on those stiffeners, and we had to get a way to speed that up. We also, because this is a high-speed vessel, had to have very, very smooth and fair skin on the outside. So the accuracy standards are, on a 38-foot module, we are tolerating no more than a 16th of an inch out of the design shape. And that's really, really tight. But the marine architect saw this platen table that one of our guys had designed in the workforce, and he said, you guys are nuts. This will never work. You're going to put too much heat in the panel. It's going to distort. It'll never work. So we fired him. And we found another architect that said, you guys are nuts. I don't think this is going to work, but it might. So we hired him, and by God, it did work. We're about done with the hull construction. Another question?
Well, just a comment. I'm really glad that you brought up the lowest bidder issue. I have always had a little bit of a problem with that. When we're talking about something that is going to move human beings around, that's going to move our troops, it's going to move things that pertain to Homeland Security, all the dollars that are tied up into this going with the lowest bidder, I just put it with my personal life, and I certainly don't pick my health care or buy my house or any of those types of services by the lowest bidder. It's looking at the quality and what kind of guarantees come with it, and is there going to be services attached with it after, and those types of things. And I think, that's not a problem just in the industry that you're talking about. I think overall, the government seems to operate that way, but I don't think it's the best thing for us to be doing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That is true. That is an accurate observation. But the government is learning. Federal Highways is learning. There exists in the Federal Highway Administration a set of guidance documents and rules that they have responded to the fact that the way we are procuring our public transportation infrastructure, this is primarily on the highway side of things, but we want to apply it to ships next, is breaking the banks of the nation and the states, and that business, as usual, isn't going to be able to, we can't even pay for the maintenance of our highway system, let alone build new ones. So they went out, you'll start to get tired of this word, but they went out and did global benchmarking and found global best practices in foreign nations. Particularly, there were six nations in Europe where they went they were having the same problems. It was Spain and Italy and Norway, I forget the other three. And they came back with a set of global best practices and now have guidance documents on what those are. It's called Effective Public-Private Partnering for Innovative and Alternative Procurement. And an example of how that works, if you have a publicly funded project and you can identify any section of Title 23, the Federal Acquisition Regulations, that's either driving up your cost or your schedule out, you can file for Special Experimental Project 15 status, and if it's granted by Federal Highways, you can waive that Title 23 requirement and come in and demonstrate a faster, better, cheaper program. I think we ought to declare Alaska a Special Experimental Project and get on with the optimal investment of our money that reduces the cost and accelerates the time that we get these things in the ground. And that's kind of the we quite haven't had that discussion with AMHS yet, but they're open to that kind of discussion on the Alaska class vessel. So we're looking forward to having some demonstration projects like that. This again is another advanced manufacturing process that was thought up by some of our guys. One guy had worked in a plant back in the Midwest that made rail cars. And in the back, you can see a circular table. It's called a positioner. What we're doing now are taking those stiffened panels and then the bulkheads to the ship, or what you see the vertical plane, and they're slipped over that long mandrel. And what that's doing, the bulkheads of the ship is defining the shape of the vessel. So it's actually the jigs and the tooling that we use to bring put those stiffened panels onto it. The positioner rolls that entire module around 360 degrees for ergonomically correct welding, where we can also use automated welders. The same marine architect looked at that, the plan for that, and he said, "You guys really are nuts. That thing's for making freight cars." We said, "Well, you're fired again, sir." And we went with the same architect. And he said the same thing, but he said that might work too, and it actually did. Here you see one of the modules coming out of the shop. Now what used to be the tooling is now the bulkhead, and it'll stay with the ship as a permanent part. So it reduced our setup time, reduced the cost of the ship, and it's going to give us globally competitive manufacturing practices for building the commercial versions of this really exciting technology for new ships in Alaska. So even if we don't have the proprietary rights to the design, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tuck.
Okay, sorry, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
And I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you were saying that this is going to be a global design that can then be used for mass production. Are we going to be able to do that here, or we don't have the rights to do so? It sounds like we have the capabilities of doing it, but...
Yes, we have an exclusive license on the original Lockheed intellectual property. This design, though, by the way, interesting twist, Lockheed Martin used to have a lot of shipyards, and they have a marine division, and they fully expected to be the general contractor in this project. But as we were going through the design spiral and approaching a contract design and going through the concept planning stage, because they're such a huge organization, they weren't able to bring the kind of innovation. Another advantage we have is we don't have 200. We just started in this business back in 1994. Was our first full year in it, and we were contractors in Ketchikan supporting the pulp mill. What we saw in the shipyard was wintertime demand for ferry maintenance work, and what we wanted to do was keep 35 people busy. We had no idea that this was going to happen to us. We wanted to keep our construction crew maintaining the pulp mill in the summer and then maintaining ferries in the winter. And, of course, no one expected the pulp mill to close when it did, but it did. And it was actually the state and the community of Ketchikan came to us and said, are you guys maximizing the economic returns from your planning? We said, well, no, we just want to work in the winter. Year-round employment. And they said, well, here's some planning money. Step up. We want more jobs here. So it was that employment factor. As we saw a loss of roughly 20% of our economy hit us right in the face, 1,000 jobs gone overnight, which, by the way, were very high-skilled and highly paid jobs, and it took some of the best and brightest out of our society down there. So, we I guess we didn't know how complicated this was going to be, or we probably wouldn't have started it.
one other question.
How long did it take to from design to completion for this? Are the ship still ongoing?
We're about 50% done with construction of it. The design process has taken years. The weights and balances on this thing are just incredible. It's been a real monster. In fact, the design is... Even at 50% construction, we're still hitting issues that we're having to go back and redo the detailed design. But that's why it's a science and technology project and not a standard competitively bid project. Now to the workforce. And this is the third part of concurrent development. And I also work for Chairman Lynch on the Workforce Investment Board, and I chair the Workforce Readiness Committee. And we've got other members of the Workforce Investment Board here. We had our winter meeting up here this week. And I've got to say, I've been on that Workforce Investment Board for, this is my fifth year. And, when Governor Palin took office, one of the first things she did was pass a resolution supporting career and technical education, and then she told the commissioner, Bishop, get that Workforce Investment Board off its duff and tell them to take back their statutory authority and get to work or disband. It's taken us a couple of years, but I would say, fellows, it's starting to be fun now. We're really starting to get some good initiatives coming out of that thing, and we also now have fiduciary control over all of the funds that are going into training around the state, which includes career and technical education in the school. So I appreciated your comment about that. Commissioner Ledoux came to our meeting today. He's very interested in beefing up career and technical education in the schools, because you're correct. It keeps the kids in the school. It makes sure they're going to graduate. And if there's a job at the end of that, there's nothing wrong with that either. So that's what we're doing on the board in addition to it. In 1999, I was back in Washington, D.C., and I went to a shipyard workforce and organizational conference there, and started down this path of found out there that the Admiral of the Navy was pretty upset with the U.S. shipbuilding industry. At that time, we enjoyed less than 0.5% of the global demand for commercial shipbuilding, and he was not happy about that. He relies on the Tier 2 and Tier 3 yards, or the smaller yards. We're a Tier 3 moving to a Tier 2. The Tier 1s are what used to be known as the Big Six shipyards. Now it's the Big Two with all the consolidation that's gone on. But when I heard these admirals kicking our tails, it kind of intrigued me. What we found, what he said, is I'm tired of you guys getting your competitive tails kicked by Japan and Northern Europe. They have higher wage rates than we do in Japan and in Northern Europe. But they also play in the global ship production game, and they do it very well. Northern Europe makes all of the many of the cruise lines. Japan is huge in the big box ships and things. So he sent us over to do global benchmarking to see what the best practices were. And we kept coming across, and what we have is a group called the National Shipbuilding Research Program, which the Navy funds. The idea is to have shipbuilders identify competitive weaknesses in the industry and then go do the research and figure out how to fix it, because the Navy needs a commercial shipbuilding market. And the mission of NSRP, National Shipbuilding Research Project, is to reduce the cost of building ships for the Navy. Kind of a reoccurring theme. Our deal is to reduce the cost of building and operating ships in Alaska based on globally competitive standards. So we went to Japan, and we went to Northern Europe, and we went into the HR departments and into the training halls and things, and we kept coming across the 1943 U.S. War Manpower Commission's 1943 documents titled Training Within Industry. And that was, I'm going to skip around on these slides a little bit. It was training within industry that some people, John, what's his name, John, the guy went to Japan? He'll come to me. At any rate, the War Manpower Commission realized that the Second World War was going to be a war of attrition, and we're going to have to out-manufacture both Northern Europe and Japan. And we were going to have to do it with a non-traditional workforce, because the people that had been in manufacturing, white, middle-aged, middle-class males, had just gone off to both fronts to fight the war. So what they had is this industrial base was building up with tens of thousands of test tubes or test sites to try out the best ideas for workforce development. And they kept the ones that worked, and they got rid of the ones that didn't. And that became training within industry, and it worked, because Rosie built enough planes and tanks and ships and boats that we out-manufactured them. We also used those weapons to destroy the global industrial base, which at the end of the war, because we had an industrial base, we were the only ones left that could satisfy this huge unmet demand for manufactured products. At the same time, at that point, we forgot about being productive. And the guys that developed training within industry couldn't get work in this country. So they followed the money. They moved to Japan, and they moved to Northern Europe with the repatriation money. And they helped those countries with our money build new manufacturing plants based on modern production technology with modern tooling, all based on global competitive standards, and they took the manuals with them. So we came back, and the NSRP group came back and reported the Admiral and said, we've found out why those guys are beating us. They have our training with industry manuals. And he said, well, men, bring me one of those. Let's do that ourselves. We'd given them all away. The library, we had to go back to Mr. Toyota and borrow his copy, and it wasn't until April of 2006 that they were republished in this country. And it was kind of embarrassing, but we've got them now. So our involvement, because we had to learn this very, very complicated enterprise, and we had to learn it fast because we were competing. We had to earn the money to stay alive, and it's something we didn't really understand. So NSRP was the avenue by which we got the knowledge, and we learned about the global standards, and we adopted in 2000 another partner in this effective public-private partnership was the University of Alaska. Fred V is behind me. He went to one of the meetings, and we adopted through the Crosscut Initiative panel that I've sat on since 99, we adopted the model training plan for structured on-the-job training, which is apprenticeship. We adopted the country's first catalog of skill standards for shipbuilding, and we adopted another document from NSRP called Leading Multi-Skilled Self-Organizing Work Teams. That's what we're using as the guiding documents for developing what will be the country's first multi-skilled shipyard production worker apprenticeship. It's what they do.
Say that again.
Kind of a mouthful, isn't it? I got to get a better name for that. But it will be it'll be the North America's first multi-skilled shipyard worker apprentice program. What we need, and particularly in Ketchikan, as in an industry in the U.S., is a stable workforce. Right now, we have a very unstable workforce. They're all my age or older, ladies. We're looking for leadership. But it's the stability in the workforce that we need. We can never control what comes, you know, who's going to wreck next, what kind of work is going to come in. Is it going to be a big steel job, a big paint job? And so we need a workforce that can self-organize, that is inherently multi-skilled, and can go keep itself busy no matter what work comes to us. So that's the principle behind this multi-skilled workforce. So just a little bit of workforce theory, and I understand that to a lot of people, workforce development seems like a messy process. But with training within industry, which all it does is, first of all, teaches people how to think critically about the work. It teaches them how to identify the key skills that exist in any process and catalog those key skills, do the work breakdown. That defines the process. It then prepares the experienced worker, the knowledgeable worker, shows him how to prepare himself, the workplace, and the learner for learning. And then through a very simple methodology of telling, showing, doing, rapid transfer of knowledge to the new learner. And then there's job method improvement is a second module that has the same common sense, low cost, scientifically based ways of improving the process that you've just defined. The third module is job relations, which teaches people how to get along when you're showing, telling, doing. It worked. It taught Rosie how to weld. It went to Japan, and now Japan is winning the economic war because it became the basis of the Toyota production system, and it's why Toyota is making more cars in this nation than we are. It morphed into lean production or lean manufacturing. And today there are plane loads of consultants flying all around North America descending on small manufacturers trying to teach them Six Sigma and lean manufacturing. It's not working too well. And it's not working too well because we forgot about training within industry, how to teach your frontline supervisors to how to show other people to do work. It's that simple. It's not complicated. So, again, these are globally competitive standards, and it's what we're doing in the workforce. And I want to show you what TWI looks like. This is the Cornelia Marie, the picture in the corner. That's Brittany and Brandy, two 19-year-old women from Metlakatla. They came over last February to go to work with us. Brittany is now in the QA/QC department, technically demanding a lot of science, and if she gets it wrong, we lose money and we got to do the work over. She's excelling as a QA/QC inspector on welds and paints and all kinds of things. Brandy is over in the services department where she does all kinds of things, and she just loved it. But what they're doing here, the Cordelia Marie is one of the ships on the Deadliest Catch. And the Metlakatla High School had come over, and I usually lead the tours. Many of you follow me around the yard, and I get pretty boring. And, you know, 50 high school kids, Brittany, Brandy just graduated from, and you two go lead the tour. So they just finished leading the tour, and they were down showing off to the 50 of their friends that they'd been working on the Cornelia Marie. They're doing pretty well over there, and we're really glad to have them in our workforce. And they really love training within industry. They're learning faster than the old dogs, the old experienced hands, and are actually teaching the old guys how to do TWI. It's really fun. The other way it looks, here's Mel. She's from Metlakatla too. Actually, Melinda is her name. That's Andy DeGrand. He's older than I am. He's the guy, though, that came up with that way to bend those panels and weld them up really quick. That was Andy's idea. We taught him a little bit of TWI, and then Brittany and Brandy taught him a lot. But he's been using that to teach Mel how to weld, and those are the products he's making. Her welds are spectacular. They are beautiful. It's amazing. And she's now learning all the forming and the fabricating and the fitting and all the other multiple skills that goes into being a shipbuilder. So the apprentice occupation that we're looking for, we only want one apprenticeship in the shipyard, and that's shipbuilder. And that's what we're going to have. And then we will have what happens in Europe is the workers over there carry passports with them that have a list of all of their competencies. So within this complicated enterprise, now I can't, maybe I need one of these young ladies to help me run this. These are all the different activities that go on in the shipyard, and we will help people. They'll come into our apprenticeship program down at the bottom of those triangles, and they'll take a year or two kind of sorting out and finding this. It takes 2 years to get somebody even marginally productive in a shipyard. Then, if they're interested, they can enter this multi-skilled apprentice program. What we need are production-level workers. Most of the work is done by the equivalent of an associate degree. That kind of learning is required. And then as time goes on, they may take an interest in welding or electrical or pipe fitting or something. But we'll develop a career path with them, and they will go through these different areas and specialties on a career path. And one last thing on this, and then I'll quit. This stuff is all transportable. Concurrent development can be done in any industry, in any community in Alaska. We are taking the TWI methodology. They used to use a blackboard to teach it, but we've got it online. We have, through the University of Alaska, we've developed the Alaska System of Shipyard Education and Training asset. We have a whole series of curricula that we're getting through the community college system from shipbuilding centers all around the nation. And what we will do, and when the Alaska Municipal League came down, there were 50 mayors and managers in our yard. It dawned on me, you know, if we, you know, it's young Alaskans that are going to build our ships of the future. And I said, I'll tell you what, take this message back to your school districts. If you have people that want, young kids that want to learn this business, shipbuilding and repair, we will let them come onto our corporate learning center online in their homes, in their villages, and begin studying this, the theory and principles online, begin earning apprenticeship credits while they're in high school. They can come down and for summer work experiences, go back and finish high school, and come out almost an apprentice. And in this state, if you graduate out of an apprentice program, the University of Alaska will give you 38 college credits, so you're halfway to an AA degree. So those are some of the globally competitive, innovative, highly innovative things that we're doing down in Ketchikan, and we're doing it because we're Alaskans. So I've taken way too much time. I apologize for that.
Doug, can we, first of all, it's a phenomenal presentation, just phenomenal. Can we ask you some broad brush questions and try and kind of get some, just pepper you with some questions and get some succinct answers and try and wind up by 7. Is it when you say public-private, is it a for-profit entity? Who are the owners? How much money have you borrowed from ADA? Is it working? Are you making money? Is ADA subsidizing it? That's my first.
I'll try and answer those in order. Okay. ADA owns the property. It was bought by the state of Alaska in the 80s. Through an intergovernmental transfer, transferred to DOT over to ADA. We haven't borrowed any money from ADA. We have gone out diligently and taken this concurrent development approach back to Congress and here in Juneau, and have secured roughly $77 million of public funding to build this yard. So we are making money. We're a profit-making corporation. We have to earn a profit. We do pay a dividend into ADA. But the trick here is going to get all, we need to get all that infrastructure in place so we can get up to that 350 workers in order to get the volume of work up. So that, because in this job we sell man hours. I mean, that's what we do. We're a service company, and we sell the customer man hours. The more competitive and the more productive we are, the more we can earn. So it's imperative that we have a knowledgeable, skilled, and experienced and stable workforce. So as we're approaching that, our profitability will increase and our payments back into ADA's fund, which, by the way, this is one of the few infrastructure projects in the state that has a dedicated maintenance fund. That was one thing ADA was insistent on, that we pay some of our earnings into a dedicated repair and replacement fund. So there's a lot of pretty innovative financial tricks, and that's the things that ADA does well.
I'm aware of that provision, and I hate it in my ADA loan. So just for what it's worth, two different guys can have two different opinions on the R&R account, and I think it's one of the worst features of an ADA loan. But that's different guys, different points of view.
All right.
Are there other questions for Doug from any members? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where are you guys getting all the steel? How is the steel getting shipped to you? Where are you storing it? How are you warehousing it? How are you keeping it from getting all rusted out?
Well, that's why you saw all those big enclosures. Right now we're building the MVs to sit outdoors. And, you know, I should have put that in there, but this year we've had more snow in Ketchikan than anybody can remember.
Really?
And it's been a real challenge. That's why we need that enclosure. But to answer your question, it depends on the job. Let's take the new dry dock for an example. Using standard procurement processes, and I don't mean this as an indictment of anybody, but it's just how we, you know, do business. That was, at the time, came with a $5 million U.S. Economic Development Administration grant, and they don't have a Buy America requirement. They suggest that you do. But using the standard design bid build low bid wins approach, we failed, and I mean we all together failed in getting a procurement, because the longer we went, the steel prices were rising, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. In the third round of bidding, there was only one other bidder from Vancouver Shipyards, a foreign country, and they were twice the budget, the $10 million budget for the dry dock. So at that point, EDA said, okay, you folks have failed three times. You are now authorized to go do a commercial buy on the global market for a dry dock, and U.S. Economic Development Administration dollars went to China to build that shipyard. Now, that was unfortunate. It would have been, I think, a more constructive approach to negotiate a best value to owner contract with the state and let us, on our first vessel, build a very simple vessel rather than one of the most complicated vessels designed in 100 years. And that's my personal opinion, but that's where this innovative and alternative procurement and effective public partnering can take us. So if there is a Buy America, then we buy it domestically. And right now, we don't have the cutting tables. We're buying out of Oregon, where they've got the big fancy numerically controlled cutting machines, and it comes up all cut to shape and marked and stamped, and then we're assembling it.
Other questions?
I have a comment.
Representative Johansson.
If we're almost done.
We are almost done.
Excellent. Now you can all understand why I'm so enthusiastic about the shipyard.
Yep.
That's all I have. Doug does a great job, and he works with the university, with the Department of Labor, and it's just exciting to be part of this. I think you all got a taste of the things we're doing down in Ketchikan, and I'm just really happy, and you can tell why I talk about it all the time.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to add a little bit to that one. We were down in Ketchikan here, you know, I forgot, it's like last year now, isn't it, for the GIA hearings. I had a chance to go through the shipyard with Doug, and if you think it looks cool on paper, you should see it in person.
Doug, is there anything that the state can do to help you at this point, or just stand down out of the way?
Well, there's yes, there are lots of things to do. This whole workforce issue, it's all very innovative, and it's not going to be cheap to do this. The infrastructure behind just what we want to end up with is a wireless network within the yard where a handheld PDA can access all of the training modules, all the contract specifications, all the learning modules, so that the knowledge is right down on the deck plates where people can use it to make good decisions rather than have to walk up to see the general manager who probably can't find the plans and the specs anyway. So the work, state assistance with the Department of Labor and university working together, not only how we develop a skilled and knowledgeable workforce, but how we sustain a skilled and knowledgeable workforce, not only for the shipyard, but you know, we have the AGEA strategic training plan with 113 high priority occupations. We employ 72 of those occupations. So what we do, and when AGEA comes along, we already pay over the industry average domestically, but we know we're going to lose workers to those very high-paying gas line jobs. So, you know, we need to figure out, and not just my company, but what are we going to do statewide to protect the incumbent employers that are currently employing the legacy jobs that are going to be here after the gas pipeline is done?
With all due respect, I expect that I will be an old man before AGEA comes along. But, again, differing opinions on the subject matter. So is there anything that the state can do immediately to assist you, or do you feel that you're growing organically? And then I assume that the state of Alaska will not go out, as Representative Dahlstrom said, to any competitive bid, that they will first look to the Ketchikan shipyard to build any, to build and maintain any future needs. Do they have some exclusivity with you now, or are you finding yourself competing with Vancouver for any Alaskan products?
We actually do compete, and we actually repair some BC ferries in Ketchikan. You know, there's a couple things that we can do to help. One is going to be, I believe it's House Bill 105, which has to do with the STEP program, the State Training and Employment Program. When that was reauthorized last year, you folks told the commissioner that we'll give you two more years for STEP, and that's we're using STEP money to train Brittany and Brandy and all these young people in this complicated enterprise. But last year STEP was in trouble. We have a STEP grant now, and I'll confess to you that there's lots of room for streamlining and improvement in the STEP program, but the commissioner put me on the STEP task force that you required him to do. Our STEP report hit the building yesterday, and Representative Coghill has House Bill 105, which will get the statutory basis that we at the task force need so we can dive into the policy and regulations and streamline and make it work for Alaska's employers and workers.
Doug, do you have a relationship with the World Trade Center who presented here? Are they aware of your capabilities, and are they assisting in marketing your services to the Pacific Rim, the West Coast of the United States?
Not yet, Mr. Chairman, but that's a heck of an idea. We will by noon tomorrow.
What we'd like to do is to have you spend a few minutes with Margaret as we get done, just to tell you about that, because that's precisely what they do, and we actually talked about exporting our skilled workforce to that effort, and it's a great opportunity to offer an expansion of the what the remarkable things that you're doing down in Ketchikan. Are there any other closing remarks as we reach the 7 o'clock bell, Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned Rosie the Riveter, and one of the things I've learned also, the reason why the production went up and the reason why mistakes were less was actually women were reading the manuals, unlike men in the factories. They were actually reading the manuals. I want to say that this is a fantastic presentation. I just want to say, wow, I'm really excited. My big thing was my vision for the state of Alaska, this really ties into it, and that's to start manufacturing, start investing in our university systems, not only fully fund our science and technology facilities, but go one step further with the materials development and prototype institute. That way, when the students learn the science and technologies, they can come up with the process methods, the machine tool technologies, which sounds like what you guys are doing right now down in Ketchikan, and applying those entrepreneurially right here for our state. And that I did not know that this model was already taking place, and I think it's the example that we can do in applying to other industries, new industries for Alaska. So thank you so much for the presentation, and thanks for Mr. Chairman for having it.
Well said, and we thank you for putting this together, Representative Johansson, and also to Barbara Dowling, to Margaret Dowling, to putting this program together. We are delighted. Very impressive presentation, and do you have any information on how somebody can reach you? Is that on the first slide, or is it not on?
You know, I don't have that on there, but it'll be on by 9 o'clock tonight. I will give Margaret my contact information. And
perfect. So anybody who wants to reach you for any additional information, our phone number is 465-3004. And we're just delighted. So impressive. You're practically a motivational speaker. Thank you very much. Any final thoughts? Seeing none, it's 7 o'clock and we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.